not
especially in Boston. I used to work with a team in Boston. They they're completely wide open and just rip you to shreds, basically.
Well, and even if you're working with people over in like Amsterdam or other, like they're very candid and forthright with their communication style. And you know exactly what the expectations are. Like, to me, that's a gift.
Welcome to Embracing Digital Transformation, where we investigate effective change leveraging people, process, and technology.
This is Darren Pulsford, Chief Solution Architect, author, and most importantly, your host. On today's episode, Digital Transformation for the C-Suite with special guest Leilani Bloomquist. Leilani, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Leilani, first off, your name's pretty cool.
Thank you.
It's a Hawaiian name, right?
It is. That's correct. Yes.
So are you from Hawaii?
I am not. I have an auntie and uncle who have been frequenting Hawaii since far before I was born, and they had some influence since I'm the third of three girls. And so they got to be a little unique and creative with the last name.
It's a beautiful name. And I recognize it from, I've been to Hawaii a couple of times, so I recognize the name from there. So, but before we talk about our backgrounds of our names, Leilani, tell my audience a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, happy to. Like many people of my age and generation, we didn't start in digital. Digital was very much just coming of age. And so I ended up making my way into digital via project management. I had had a mix of marketing and sales and event coordination and project management in my early career. And once I made my way into digital project management, I found my sweet spot. I loved the intersection of technology and how we could really quickly utilize that and see the impacts on the marketing and the business goals, and really started to bring that voice of the customer forward. And so that was a big inflection point for me in my career. And thankfully, I had fantastic leadership who saw my excitement in working in the space and then had the opportunity to build and grow digital teams. I had a stint of leading an innovation lab for 3.5 years. And have since been in the consulting space for a little over 4 years now, helping leaders define their digital strategy, transformation roadmaps, and really specifically looking at the intersection of people, process, and technology to define what needs to be true to make really thoughtful progress against those goals.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about your own transition, right? Because you were in project management around event planning primarily, or was it lots of other different
marketing
things,
marketing project management and event coordination.
Mm-hmm. So describe what that transition was for you to move from what you were doing to what you call digital digital project management. What's the difference?
Honestly, it's just managing different assets and timelines, right? So events, you had more people, food, places, venues, but it was still just managing a lot of like people and timeline and deliverables. And in digital, it just became a little different type of assets and timelines and deliverables that you were managing. The difference was, right, you could utilize the technology and really start to test and understand the impact it would have from an organizational standpoint. And I remember one of the first projects I had the opportunity to be heavily involved with in the digital space was implementing chat. And initially it was just seen as like, oh, this fun little thing
little
our
chat,
company might like play around with. And I got really excited because I could see the potential here. And we were able to grow chat into the third largest converting channel for organization as we took that little like pilot test and continued to grow the adoption across the organization, really leaning into some of our salespeople that were really excited about the technology and wanted to be on the receiving end of answering those chats and supporting those conversations. And it was fun to see how quickly we could actually make an impact, meet our customers where they were at. And we had a lot of insights that people were on our company website and wanted to have those conversations, but they didn't always want to pick up the phone, which was more the traditional conversion channel, one of the higher converting channels at the time. And so it was fun to really bring in that voice of the customer and see how important it was to meet them where they're at, regardless of what channel they preferred. And it was also really exciting to see some of those early adopters on the sales team really get involved and help work really closely with them to expand what those chat offerings were and what role it could play for the organization.
That's really interesting because you and I have a similar but opposite background.
Yeah.
So I started on the technology side. I'm a software engineer. And when I graduated from college, I did software engineering. So software engineers were a little hubris in that we believe that software can solve all the world's problems, which I still kind of believe that, but you know. But I found out that even having really cool technology didn't mean that everyone would adopt it. And you came the other direction around, where you're coming in with the people skills and all those skills and seeing technology and how it can be leveraged by people. I think that's wonderful. I went the other way around. I'm like, I've got cool technology. I'm going to force people to use it.
Yeah.
Didn't work so well, right?
Yeah.
I think this would be an interesting discussion today. So from your experience in that transition and then also helping other, because now you consult with companies on how to do these transitions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, and you talk people, process, technology, that's the tagline of the show. So you're perfect fit. What do you think has the largest impact on digital transformation of people, process, and technology? What's the number one thing that you've seen from your vast experience
success? Honestly, the leadership in the organization is going to have the largest impact on the success or failure of your transformation program. It's really critical for the C-suite to be 100% bought in and championing, being a huge champion and having the correct language to talk about the why we're going to lean into changing, right? Why we need to do things differently in the future versus what got us to this point of success today. And them both having the language to be able to tell that story, as well as them being a champion and level setting the expectations for all of their direct reports and leadership team, and even being able to tell that story to the board is so critical, because if it doesn't have the support at the C-suite and the level setting of the expectations that we're going to need to do things differently as a company, as a leadership team, culturally, et cetera, it doesn't matter what technology you throw at it. If you don't have that buy-in and support of, we are going to lean into how can we do things differently and better, and that will mean change, you will see failure, because it's a bit like trying to push a boulder up a mountain if it starts at like the director or VP level, if that C-suite isn't fully bought in. So leadership, hands down, will make the biggest impact.
Something interesting you mentioned there, the why. You said they need to be able to explain the why.
Yeah,
I think it's fascinating that you brought that up, because I've seen that in digital transformations that I've helped organizations with.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem I've run into is success.
Yeah.
If an organization is already successful, why change?
Yeah.
Have you run into that too?
I have. And sometimes it can be the question of, do people have the foresight and vision to understand starting to invest in transformation when you are at a place of power and success actually sets you apart from your competition? And like, let's go back to a really perfect example, right? The Blockbuster versus Netflix.
Oh, right? That's a great example.
And like Blockbuster was, you know, top of their game.
Blockbuster, right?
They were a Blockbuster, right?
Oh, yeah.
And really didn't pay much attention to Netflix and some of these other things that were starting to happen in the industry. And if they had started to invest in change earlier on when they came from a place of power, who knows what they would actually have been today? Versus if you're starting from a place of insecurity or risk because you're already starting to see income streams drop and all these other competitors come into your landscape. It's just a very different defensive or reactive versus proactive approach. And so what I usually say is, one, great job, because if you were able to grow your company and get to this level of success with the tools and tech and processes that you have in place today, that usually speaks volumes to the staff that you have, their level of commitment, And generally, if you start to peel back the layers on what's happening organizationally, a lot of times what got you to that point of success is oftentimes heroics and people constantly going the extra mile and a lot of like manual work and support happening, right? And so people are working really hard and smart. And there's an opportunity to look at how can we continue to grow and be much more efficient with our very human and fantastic resources, time and energy, and look at different ways to drive more operational efficiencies so our staff can actually work smarter and harder for us without adding more to their plates, more of that manual overhead. And so it's just an opportunity to be really proactive, to continually look at how can we do things better. And we all know that all of the tech that's coming in, it's almost like popcorn effect, right? You're hearing about new tech and advancements nonstop. And there is an opportunity to be thoughtful around how can we start to use some of this tech to make some thoughtful impacts on our teams and how we work. And it just allows you to be much more in control of those investments and those reactions versus having to be super reactionary because all of a sudden...
Right, because I'm already losing my revenue streams.
You're already losing it. You're already behind the curve. Yeah,
so isn't there a dilemma? I don't know.
Yeah.
If I am successful, mm-hmm. why change? Because any change I introduce, we all know this. I've got my MBA. They teach it to us, right? Introduce change, expect decrease in productivity at first. It's the typical cycle, right? Decrease in productivity and then huge gains later on.
Yeah.
But if you guess wrong, mm-hmm. that decrease in productivity may stick. And that's a concern that people have. So how do you know if the change that you're trying to enact is the right change or not?
Well, one, I would say creating a culture where you have really strong change agility as a leadership and as a broader organization is really critical because the only constant that we have in business is change. Like that literally is the only constant. So change is coming whether we want it or not. Looking at how we can develop those muscles of change agility and also be really thoughtful and strategic around where we're investing and being really thoughtful of building out a change management program and support. So you're understanding what people need, how they learn best, right? What type of communication works best to bring people along so they don't feel like they're in the dark and it's this big bang kind of surprise. And also continuing to work on that culture of, if we think about the really highly innovative companies out there, like people can have whatever opinion they want of the Amazons and the Metas and the Facebooks, but the frequency that which they test and learn and change is just massive, right? Like those companies, all they do is constantly change and evolve. And that's a part of their company DNA. And I don't think most companies necessarily need to be at that level from like a test and learn and innovate and change process and refinement. But as a leadership team and as a group, building in that culture of change agility and also being really thoughtful and strategic around where you're putting those investments and how you're supporting the very people and human side of change, usually where you see more confidence and success with adoption of change is when you have really strong change management programs. So you're anchoring the story of why you're changing to your company mission and vision and values. You're speaking a very simple language of the business of why is this important and what impact is it going to have? And then also making sure that you're training and communicating with people in the way that they learn best. And there's this common saying of people oftentimes need to hear things 7 times 7 different ways for really.
Yeah.
And
that's true, isn't it?
Very true. Yeah. And so you can't just do a one and done or an email blast or an email that's, you know, 14 paragraphs long. That's not effective communication. And so there's this element of effective communication that also needs to be a part of any change program.
Now, I've noticed change in mid-sized companies and small companies is much more attainable. Mm-hmm. than in really large companies.
Yeah.
Is that just because of the sheer number of people that you're trying to get to change? Or why is that? Because I've been in organizations that are going through massive changes. Mm-hmm. And I find there's groups of people that just drag their feet. We call them culture keepers, right? Yeah. They just drag. They say, if I outlast you long enough, I win.
Yeah.
But it only serves them personally. It doesn't serve the company. Are you seeing the same thing in large, and is that only in large companies, or are you seeing that in small and mid-sized companies as well?
I feel like one of the benefits of a mid-sized company is there's just generally less layers of bureaucracy and decision-making.
Yeah,
and so you're able to drive decisions at a more expedient timeline because there's less people involved driving those decisions. Also larger companies, you have a much larger ship that you're trying to steer in a certain direction, right? And depending on the organization, if they're more heavily bureaucratic, you have a lot of layers to align. And so that's where sometimes the biggest change needs to come in the operating system more so than like the technology. And so the product-led operating model, when it's done well, really does push the right level of decision-making down to the appropriate
down as far as you possibly can. Level.
Exactly. Yeah. And that alleviates some of the stress of the bureaucracy and the decision-making in the upper levels. Now, leadership needs to be really clear on their strategy and their roadmap. And I will also say just as clear on areas that they're not willing to invest for whatever reason, right? It might bring risk into the organization, et cetera, for that product model to work really well and efficiently. And leaders need to be okay releasing some of that control of like the details of the
how. Yeah, isn't that the tough part?
But, you know, there are elements that can help large organizations move faster. But candidly, there's just so many more people involved that it tends to be a slower change. And sometimes it's also just due to the level of complexity of the organization and understanding the impacts and ripple effects of change of a very large corporation versus a midsize.
So you said something interesting. It's almost counterintuitive. If you want effective change, you need to push decisions down the bottom.
Yeah.
Because I've noticed when big corporations go through massive change, they start micromanaging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because that's what they think. And that includes a simple example, like travel, mm-hmm. right? Companies that say, we got to tighten the belt. What do they add? They add levels of process. So now no one can travel without a senior VP's permission.
Yeah.
Right. So now you've pushed that decision all the way up to a senior VP because mm-hmm. I'm going to control cost. And what you're saying is that's the wrong way to go.
Yeah. Likely it's a very poor use of a senior VP's time to be reviewing whether or not an associate travels to a conference or to go see a client face to face, right? Like that.
What would be a better way for that senior VP to still control costs without getting stuck in the middle of approving everyone's travel?
I think the appropriate level would be to tell their managers, this is the budget that you have to manage to each quarter or year. And by the way, you get to control what you approve and don't approve. And I expect you to stay at or under this budget. And then let them work with your finance team. Like it's level setting those really clear and crisp expectations and then allowing the people at the lower levels to make
to actually do the work. Yeah.
Yeah.
The reason I like this simple example is because everyone can relate to it.
Yeah.
And it's and I love it because what you mentioned was important. Push the decisions on who's traveling where down to the people that know,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
This customer really needs someone face to face, right? And my budget allows me to do that.
Right.
Right. So I like what you're saying. On bigger things, how do you coach executives to give up the micromanagement or it's almost like a false sense of power, a false sense of control. Mm-hmm. When they're micromanaging everything, it's kind of like a false sense of control, isn't it?
100%. Yeah. And they're likely trying to make decisions on things that they just don't have the level of detailed context that could be really valuable to influence that decision, right? And it's because of scale and scope, right? So if you're trying to, and we'll use the travel as an example, if you're trying to say, I don't know that you need to travel to, you know, Johnson Distributors, whatever, XYZ company, right? Because we don't think the client needs face-to-face. Maybe what they don't know is that face-to-face could double or triple the revenue and the relationship. And so putting a couple thousand dollars into that travel investment is going to pay it back, you know, 10, 20, 30 fold. And so there is this element of trust. And I always lean into like, what level of appropriate autonomy and trust should you be leading with? And it's really critical for you and me as a leader in that company to be crisp and clear on what my expectations are. And so you can give up control when you have crisp and clear expectations. And that expectation might also be once a month, I want you to send me a status update of how we're doing on our burn rate for those travel budgets, right? And that takes me as a leader being clear of my expectations of my direct reports, of what I want proactively sent back to me, and then also allowing them the space to actually do the work appropriately and only addressing it if it's not showing up or meeting expectations. But I think sometimes where the micromanagement also comes in is you're not really crisp and clear on goals and communication and expectation setting. And in the Midwest, now I live in the Midwest, those conversations are sometimes not really candid and forthright. You see a little bit more of that candid and forthright conversations on the coast. And we're not,
especially in Boston. I used to work with a team in Boston. They, they're completely wide open and just rip you to shreds, basically.
Well, and even if you're working with people over in like Amsterdam or other, like they're very candid and forthright with their communication style. And you know exactly what the expectations are. Like, to me, that's a gift, right? So give yourself and your team that gift and also allow them some trust. And usually when you give people expectation, clear expectations and trust, they rise to the occasion. Very rarely does it go in the different direction.
Tops down change. I love this because the way you described it is full alignment.
Yeah.
What about bottom up change? For example, something very disruptive is happening right now.
Yeah.
Generative AI is just, executives don't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. Individuals are using it like crazy because they're finding a really good use of it. Mm-hmm. And this really reminds me of the change that we saw in the 90s with email and with internet. It's a fundamental way that we're changing, that we're doing work. Mm-hmm. How do I as an executive manage that kind of change that I don't necessarily want? Right. But maybe I do want, because I don't maybe see the benefits of the change yet, but all of my workers are using it. All my workers are already changing the way that they work. What do I do?
That one's a really interesting and of course a very hot topic, right? Everyone is trying to figure out what to do with it, how scared they should be or excited they should be about it. And I just look at it as the next evolution of our tools in tech, right? Chat also felt really disruptive at the time, you know, 15 years ago, right? When it was kind of becoming more prevalent overall and people were trying to figure out what in the world to do with it. And I also, I feel like I've heard more feedback that boards are actually pushing executives to figure out what they're going to do with it. And the executives feel like they're unsure of what they're going to do with it. My biggest advice is actually carve out a little bit of budget and capacity and assign a team to help define what should that strategy and maybe year one roadmap look like of how people can start to really lean in and test and learn in AI. And depending on your industry, also ensure that you're being really thoughtful and driving strong partnerships with your regulatory and compliance, because you might need different lockdown internal sandboxes and not share. You know, there is that true risk of sharing proprietary information.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just more broadly. But saying it's not going to happen isn't actually a strategy or a plan. It's going to happen. So give it the appropriate funding and support to figure out some of those early opportunities and use cases for your organization and figure out some tests so you can start to test and learn. that's my biggest advice, is actually assign a team, a cross-functional team, both from like business and tech and security, you know, regulatory, all of those, if you have that in your business structure, and prioritize it, because it's coming, whether it's here, right? It's not even coming, it's here, and it's going to
continue to evolve.
I think it has huge opportunities to continue to drive efficiencies. And I am also not fearful at all of us not needing the very human component in ingesting, editing, you know what I mean? Like even refining, writing the prompts, being thoughtful of the biases, right, that are in the data and the prompts and how we're asking the questions, et cetera. So I think there's just, there's big opportunity there. One, I would say, don't stick your head in the sand. Two, give it appropriate staffing and funding so you can start to it, and then build in a little bit of a governance around it. So if it's a steerco that's reviewing, you know, the opportunities and the use cases, right? So you can start to test and learn, and then also see where there's potential scaling opportunities within your organization. But this whole just let people do it off the side of their desk and experiment, one, you can potentially have proprietary information, you know, being leaked without the appropriate structure around it. And there is something to be thoughtful of. And two, don't fear it. It's here and it's exciting. So figure out what the appropriate.
So I like what you said here, because I could apply this not just to Gen AI, but any new both technology and or business model that comes out. I need to be, like you said before, a agile to change organization. So I do need people investigating new ways of doing things. I do need that in my organization, or I'm proverbially, I can't even talk today. I end up like Kodak or like the best buggy whip company in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
Right. Where I'm still the best buggy whip company in the world, but
no one needs you anymore.
Don't need it anymore, right? Yeah. And I think it's fascinating when we study Kodak, for example. Kodak had people that were out there explaining. Kodak even had digital cameras. But they couldn't make the adjustment in the end, right? Because they that was just a side project, right? It was just off on the side. I'm going to dabble in it. But ultimately, they stuck to, I'm a film company.
Right.
And so they weren't able to adapt. Leilani, if people want your help, what do they do? And what, you know, how do you come in and help organizations, both big and small and massive? How do you help them? What's it look like engaging with you?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for asking. You know, the engagements can look a little different. What I will share is people are at very different inflection points. People are at very different inflection points on their journey of where they're investing in transformation. So depending on where the company is at from a maturity standpoint with transformation, sometimes I find that they've just stalled out and they're not seeing the adoption that's needed and necessary to drive the change. And so there are times when I really come in and work more from the change management side of things. And I partner with leaders and teams to understand what's happening. Oftentimes I'm brought in to mid-size organizations by their C-suite because it is a bit of a popcorn effect and they have a lot of ideas swirling within their organization and they're not sure where to start. And so a discovery engagement gives us about 90 days of really concise focus time to go deep and understand where they're at in their organization, where they're at in their maturity model, even understanding what resources and talent they have in sight. And then I have a structured workshop, which helps pull all of the ideas in a very democratized way, in a very collaborative way across, out of the organization. And then we work through how we prioritize those and really lean in what needs to be true to move things forward and what are the dependencies. And generally out of that 90 days, one of the most important things comes out of it is that you have executive alignment on the key priorities for that initial investment in the year one and two of transforming. And two, there's a lot of clarity around where you need to invest from a people, process, and tech to start making thoughtful progress against the goals. And throughout a lot of that, very naturally comes the strategic advisory and coaching of leaders around mindset shifts and even shifts into ensuring your customers are at the forefront of all of the planning and thoughtfulness. So keeping that CX, that customer experience, and customers can be internal and external, really at the forefront. But I love having the opportunity to work with leaders who need to calm the chaos and get a lot of clarity around how to thoughtfully start to make progress against their goals. And generally that's done via, you know, reaching out to me on LinkedIn or via my website, which is just LeilaniBloomquist.com. But I absolutely love having the opportunity to meet with leaders across industries and see how I can best support them with their goals.
Do you feel, now this is a totally loaded question though, but do you feel like organizations need someone from external to come and help them figure this out, or can it happen internally? Or do you really need someone that's away from all the politics of the organization in order to really come and make a difference?
Great question. What I would say is it can be valuable to engage a consultant to support this work, especially early on, because one, most of the time, the leadership and the resources are already over capacity. And so there's a question of who has the true capacity to give to this body of work. And if you also tap into a resource like myself or a consulting firm, just more broadly, we also bring in a point of view around where we might see some gaps in areas of opportunity from a skill set or leadership or functional area perspective. I've also been brought in to help craft job descriptions for senior leaders. And what I always recommend is we'll do that after the 90-day engagement, because then the job description can be written specifically for what the organization and the leadership really needs are to be really thoughtful about moving that forward. And so one, it really comes down to capacity. Who has the capacity to truly give this the support and structure it needs? And sometimes it's just a matter of having done this before, right? So it doesn't mean it's not anything that can't be learned, but who's coaching and advising the leaders as they're stepping into transforming and thinking about new ways of working and how to do it? You're going to see much faster progress if you have dedicated resources helping move that along. And that, of course,
like you said,
different ways.
Yeah, from a different perspective too, right? It's good to have someone come in. Leilani, it's been a pleasure talking today. Great insight. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Darren. It was a pleasure chatting with you today.
Thank you for listening to Embracing Digital Transformation today. If you enjoyed our podcast, give it 5 stars on your favorite podcasting site or YouTube channel. You can find out more information about Embracing Digital Transformation at embracingdigital.org. Until next time, go out and embrace the digital revolution.